I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, the founder of Women for Women International, an organization that assists female survivors of war in countries including Rwanda, Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Women for Women has provided over $100 million in direct aid and microfinance loans, and the organization also helps women start their own small businesses. Zainab grew up in Iraq, where her family had ties to Saddam Hussein. Her father was his personal pilot. She is the author of Between Two Worlds, a memoir that describes her life growing up under Saddam's Ba'athist regime, and The Other Side of War, Women's Stories of Survival and Hope. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you were growing up in Iraq, what did you dream to be?
Oh, well, like as any child and teenager, I went through a whole series of dreams from wanting to be a pilot to wanting to be an architect. But really, at the age of 15, I knew that I wanted to work with women and help women. I remember that moment very, very clearly. It was after my mom made me read so many books about women's issues and told me so many stories of what goes on with women. And I remember she was driving one evening, and I told her, when I grow up, I'm going to help women. I'm going to dedicate my life to helping women. And I remember her turning towards me, looking at me, and she says, and you can do it. And I never forgot that moment. And that has been my journey ever since. I went on a detour here and there, but really the journey started in a very early age of 23 when I started Women for Women International.
Why did your mom encourage you to read books about women?
Well, my mom, I think she wanted to pass on what happens to women. My grandmother, for example, married at the age of 13 to a man older than her. She was an orphan. And even though my grandfather was a nice guy, he was older than her. And she went through a lot of suffering in terms of being under the control of another household, basically. My grandmother made sure that all of her children, particularly her girls, went to school and finished universities. And that's the story of my mother. There was a change throughout a generation. My mom was a working woman, a college graduate. She was a biology teacher. But then she still struggled between the expectations of a modern woman, you know, working independent, and that she was a wife and a mother. And the expectations of her as a wife and a mother never changed, actually, and never adopted. The other reason is that we were living in war, and particularly with my family, we were very much close to Saddam Hussein's environment. And that meant we were closer to danger. It did not mean that we were actually protected from danger. And so for a diversity of reasons, and all of these reasons, my mom was very passionate that I had to be strong, that I had to be independent. As a teenager, she would hold me and shake me with passion. She says, you must be independent. You must be strong. Never cry. Never let anybody touch you or talk with you in the wrong way. And she's like, she even told me I should never learn how to cook or clean because no man should expect me to do that just because I was a woman.
Is your mom still alive?
My mom died, actually, at the age of 52. And in the process of her death, she gave me another beautiful journey and gifts, actually. She had Lou Gehrig's disease, and I took care of her the last year of her life. In that last year, she told me my story. Because, you see, I came to America when I was 20 years old through an arranged marriage. And I was very upset that this strong woman, my mother, who told me I have to be independent and I have to fall in love and all of these things, or I should choose my husband, all of a sudden begs me for an arranged marriage with a guy I barely knew and older than me, much older than me.
Why did she do that? Did you ever learn to understand why she did arrange the marriage ultimately?
Ultimately, 9 years later, so I was very mad at her, to be honest. But she cried, and she was like, you have to listen. You just have to do it. At the end of the day, honestly, I was a daughter who did not want to see her mother cry. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. But when she finally came for medical treatment and we knew she was dying, that's when I asked her, why, what happened? Why did you do that to me? It was only then that she wrote to me, because she could not speak at that time, she lost her voice, that she did that because she was so worried that Saddam Hussein, who, again, we were hanging out with him in the weekends and many weekdays as well, started to make comments about me as an adult woman, and she just felt it, and she said, you know, she became the lioness mother. You know, I needed to get my daughter out. Mm-hmm. It was interesting because I remember these moments, and I just saw him as my father's friend and uncle, sort of, you know. So I didn't pay attention to these moments. As an adult woman today, I do see what she saw, and I understand. And I, in retrospect, I think she is no different than mothers that, you know, the images of Vietnamese mother throwing their babies at American soldiers saying, take them. And eventually in my life, I meet a lot of women who offer me their daughters, like, take her, maybe you'll give her a better life. My mom was doing exactly the same.
And was the man an American, or?
He was Iraqi-American, and he was actually everything my mama told me not to tolerate. There was a lot of verbal abuse, physical abuse, dependence on him financially. And it's so interesting because it became a very intensive experience of a bad marriage over 3 months.
And good for you that you got out after 3 months. Other people might stick around, especially wanting to please their mothers.
Well, in these 3 months, Iraq had invaded Kuwait, and I was cut off from my family. I could not even reach them by phone, and I really had to make the decision on my own.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International, an organization that provides aid to women in war zones. So you left Iraq in 1990 when you were roughly 21 years old. What did you do professionally, or what did you pursue?
Well, up until then, I have never worked in my life in Iraq. If you come from a, you know, financially comfortable family, it's not, you don't work at all, and it's like socially outrageous. So I find myself, I left my ex-husband. I had $400 in my pocket. My first job was actually at Hallmark as a clerk, you know, and I remember being so excited to work. And then eventually I went to the Limited. I did all the things that, you know, I guess teenagers in here do it. I did it as a 21-year-old.
The Limited, the clothing company.
The clothing company. And then eventually I worked in a medical lab. And, you know, but really for 2 years, I'm really working here and there, just earning a living, you know, a translator, an assistant, all of that. It took me, so that's really between the age of 20, 21 to 23. And that's when I decided to start Women for Women. But the point is I had not much work experience at the time.
Right. But when you got your first job at Hallmark, and you mentioned that you were elated because you were working for the first time, was that your state in general, one of kind of zen and happiness having gone through this turmoil? Or what was your psychological state at the time?
Yeah. That time was a very hard time. That time, not only did I left an abusive marriage, and, you know, when I mean an abusive marriage, beside the verbal abuse and the dependent, but, you know, I was also raped in that marriage. It was really a bad arrangement. And not only did I not have any money, mm-hmm. I was cut off from my family. So it all happened at the same time for me. So I remember being glued to the TV stations at that time. Or TV, rather, and just seeing the Gulf War. It was the first time we have a coverage, I think, of a war with all the blue screens, if you remember. And I had no idea if my family were alive or dead. I managed to finally call my mom, or she called me, rather, the day before the war, and she gave me her will. And she said, I don't know if we're going to see you. You need to know we have this and this and this and this in the family in case we never see you again. So it was a very hard time in my life, actually. It was, I felt abandoned and alone and cut off from my family.
And how much did your own personal experience of conflict and chaos echo the war that the women you support experience?
They all in one picture. There is no separation, I think. I understand what it means to live in war. Mm-hmm. Now, I lived in a privileged life, nevertheless, so don't take me wrong in here, but the sound of bombs, the fear, the fear of death, you know? And I felt that as a teenager, as a child, actually.
And then even in the United States, the fear of being harmed in your own personal life.
Right.
You seem to speak so freely about what happened. Have you always been able to speak freely about it?
I was embarrassed for the longest time about it.
And then what was the turning point to say, okay, I'm going to open this valve?
One of the very women that I thought I was helping, end up helping me. And this has been really the journey. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write a book on Iraqi women right after Iraq. And I remember my publisher saying, or my agent calling, rather, and saying, you really need to write it about yourself, without knowing my story. And I cried. It's like, no, it's not about me. It's da-da-da. It's about other women. It's not about me, you know. But that day I was in Congo. And while in Congo, I honestly was, I interviewed right after that call a woman called Nabitu. And Nabitu was a 52-year-old woman, homeless, completely poor. She was telling me about how she was raped, gang raped. Her sons were forced to spread their mother's hands and legs open. Her 9-year-old, 21-year-old, 22-year-old daughters were raped, also gang raped in front of her. How the rebels not only raped them, but pillaged everything and they burnt everything. And she said, I never told this story to anybody but you. So I looked at her and said, so I am someone who talks about stories. Would you like me to keep this one secret? And she looks at me and I never forgot that moment. She says, if I can tell the whole world about my story, I would. So other women would not have to go through what I've gone through. But I can't. You can. You go ahead and tell the story, just not to the neighbors. And I had to drive five hours from Congo to Rwanda that day. And I promise you, I cried throughout these whole 5 hours because I realized in that moment that this woman, humble, illiterate, poor, homeless, you know, lost everything in her life, has far more courage than I had. And it was a breaking point in my life. It was like, I can't actually claim to serve the women if I don't act what I'm asking them to do. And that was the breaking moment.
It's interesting. Some people might have had an opposite reaction, which is, whoa, I see myself too much in these people that I'm trying to help. I want to run away from it.
I feel because I lived in fear, in dictatorships and close to a dictatorship. I mean, I lived in times in which my family was socialized with Saddam and he would talk about how he killed his best friend the night before. And I would see my parents pale and scared to death. Mm-hmm. So that fear was so much in my DNA. So I really had a choice. Generally, any concept of fear or any trigger of fear, either face it and look at it in the eyes and take a chance that I can actually overcome it or continue to be imprisoned by it. Mm-hmm. Now, in the process of writing my memoir, by confronting my fear, by showing my nakedness almost, you know, I actually protect myself. It was my freedom. I always joke and says I went through therapy and got paid for it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International. We'll hear more from Zainab coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, the founder of Women for Women International, an organization that assists female survivors of war in countries including Rwanda, Kosovo, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Zainab started Women for Women in 1993 with her then husband Amjad Atala after she learned about the war in Bosnia. So you decide to start Women for Women International. How did you wake up one day and say, this is what I want to do?
So when I finally moved to Washington, D.C., I fell in love with a wonderful man, and we got married, Amjad Atala.
A Palestinian-American.
And I went back to school. So I went back to school at George Mason University, and I remember a class that I took, that for the first time, I learned about the Holocaust. You know, they didn't teach us that back home. But that same month happened to have on the front page of Times Magazine an image, a picture of a guy behind barbed wires, very, very thin, starved guy, who very much looked very similar images to the one of the Holocaust. So I happened to be one of those people who learned about the two facts in the same month. But people said never again, but it's happening similarly things again, so we have to do something. Anyway, long story short, I was actually at Denny's midnight and talking about how we can help.
And at Denny's.
At Denny's, right.
The restaurant.
The restaurant, yes. So I was at Denny's with my former husband, Amjad, and my brother-in-law, and I was like, well, how about if we sponsor women? How about if we just send them letters, manage to exchange letters between women, show them that the world is still a good place, but then give them cash? You know, you see humanitarian aid give food or secondhand clothes or whatever. No one thinks about giving cash. And with that has a dignity and the integrity to go to the store and buy whatever it is you want. So it was June 1993, September 1993. I went to Croatia with sponsorship funds for 33 women. This is basically the program then and the program now. We ask every woman to send $30 a month to one woman survivor of war and exchange pictures and letters with her if she wishes and as she wishes for an entire year. But in September 1993, I took cash with me and names from American women from all different places. And I was like, this is how we're going to launch it, and started with 33 women. Now, this became 300,000 women.
How did you get the financing?
My former husband and I used some of the savings that we had for our honeymoon because we were newlyweds and we postponed our honeymoon. And then we raised money from, you know, different crowds, really, from Amnesty International Group, Unitarian Church Group. And that's how we started it.
Now, Amjad, you are no longer married, but how much of a role did he play in the early days with you?
He was the backbone of it. He was the one who wrote the incorporation papers. He was the one who got all the logistics aspect of it. He also was the one who worked and earned a living, you know, as I run it full time.
What was he doing working?
Gosh, I felt, you know, Amjad was actually on a PhD track at the University of Virginia, and he decided to drop out and to work really, oh, poor thing. He just, you know, was a temp and was a whatever, different things just so we can earn a living, just so we can do that. So for 3 years, I wasn't earning any living and just doing this. And we were sending 100% of every penny we raised. So we were on the brink of like saying, why, we don't know if we can do it. You know, we were like, we were poor kids to start with, and we were giving 100% of everything we had, and we were really having a hard time survive.
So what was the turning point?
The turning point was I got a check for $67,000, something like that, from Working Assets. So someone had heard me on a radio interview, nominated me to Working Assets. It's a company that donates 1% of its revenue or $1 million of its revenue a year. It's a phone company and a credit card company. Mm-hmm. I honestly did not know about that. But the check came for $67,500, I remember. And I remember looking up the sky and said, okay, I think I'm meant to stay. And that's when I stayed and hired a couple of staff, and it took us the second wind, basically.
This might be too personal for you to answer, but to what extent did the difficulties of getting Women for Women off the ground, to what extent did that cause your marriage to deteriorate?
Not at all. If anything, it was actually one of the best years of that whole period. Was a wonderful years of our marriage. Now, we went through a very hard time financially, but I remember we had no question about our commitment to what we were doing. Yeah. And just no question about commitment to each other. The marriage actually went deteriorated in far more latter years when everything was growing and it was okay and, you know, and pursuing different dreams. But that, on the opposite, if anything, it strengthened our marriage, not hurt it at all.
So you received this check for $68,000. Who was the individual who sent it to you?
I never knew. But until today, I never knew who this was. She was a listener, I think, to a radio. I honestly don't know.
By the way, you mentioned, you don't know the woman who recommended you. It could have been a man, right?
Oh, it could be a man. Yes, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, really and honestly, men have been wonderful supporters throughout from President Clinton to Mayor Bloomberg, actually, who have been really wonderful supporters to our initiative.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International, an organization that assists women who have survived wars in countries including Bosnia, Rwanda, Iraq, and Afghanistan. She's one of 20 leaders chosen by President Clinton to work on the Clinton Global Initiative LEAD program. How do you help people logistically?
Well, the development of the whole template of the project came throughout the years. You sponsor a woman for one year only. In that 1 year, she is grouped with 25 other women. And with the 25 women, she goes through two kinds of training. One, an educational program that teaches her really about her rights, her own the value of her, of being her, a woman, and the value of her own contributions, and teach her about the services that are accessible to her. So it is teaching her from her legal rights to her political rights, go vote, to nutritional health issues, to her economic values and the different things that she can do for budget management and things like that. So what we call that an educational program that goes along with very basic literacy and numeracy. Now, we also have parallel to that vocational and business skills training. And we teach women skills that has market demands. And that goes from, honestly, from food to service industries to manufacturing, meaning different things, embroideries and things like that, but much more to sell hats and gloves and whatever it is. We have partnerships with companies like Kate Spade, but also women have their own market locally, to carpentry and shoe production and all of these things. So really, we do market assessment and we teach them very, very practical skills. At the end of the year, they graduate, big ceremony. It's beautiful. They get their official certificates. And almost all the women, this is the first time, they get a certificate. And usually they frame it and put it in their living room. And then that's after that, we help them to place them in jobs, basically, and in income-generating opportunities.
Could you provide an example of how you've helped a woman?
A woman that I recently met in Afghanistan, and her name is Yakuba. And Yakuba was promised to be married at the age of 6, sent to her in-laws at the age of 6. The boy she was to marry was 9 years old. Now, they don't marry immediately. When they get married, when she was 15. And he gets killed when she was 16 and a pregnant woman. So at 16, she is a widow and a single mother living in an abusive household with his in-laws, with her in-laws. Poverty strikes, and she ends up going and selling hats in the streets of Afghanistan during the Taliban time. And she talks about how the Taliban one time saw her with a slipper, an open slipper, so her toes were showing, and they came and whipped her. But she also talked about how she grabbed that whip, the hand, and grabbed the whip and threw it. And when I asked her what occurred to you, what triggered you to do that, and she said it wasn't the pain of the beating. It was the humiliation of being beaten was more painful. Then the Taliban leave, and she joins our program with nothing, really. She learns embroidery, but she had really particular skills, you know, and so we end up hiring her as a teacher. And she took a loan on the side to start a business. 5 years later, she has $30,000 in her bank account.
We were talking before about a pivot point for you and for the organization when you received your first big check. But certainly now the organization has provided over $100 million in direct aid and microfinance credit. Were there specific allies financially or on the PR front that helped escalate the organization to a whole other level?
Well, there are a couple of pivot points in the organization for you. One was the working assets check. The second was a journalist from AP who did an article about two women, one from Michigan and one from Bosnia, and they were exchanging letters. And that got covered front pages in about 13 newspapers in America. That helped really trigger a whole new wave of media attention, and media has always been really the most important source for people to know about us and to support us. Then Oprah Winfrey Show. Oprah came to us in September 2000, as a matter of fact. I had no idea who Oprah was before. They identified us. They identified me particularly. They wanted to do a small segment. It was called Remember Your Spirit segment. And I remember going home and watching Oprah. I was like, wow, this is an amazing woman. 10 shows later, Oprah was actually a major turning point in the organization. She featured us 10 times, including the very last show as she was ending her show in 2011. And every time, almost every time she featured us on the show, we get tens of thousands of women joining us.
Conrad Hilton being the hotel entrepreneur. To what extent was your mother's voice in your mind while you were launching Women for Women, even day to day?
She caught me once being in Sarajevo during the war. She was in Baghdad. And Amjad told her, my former husband. And I remember getting a call in Sarajevo from my mom. She was livid. And she was like, I risked my life to get you out of Iraq only for you to go to another war? Are you crazy? I mean, I remember like just trying to calm her down and feeling I was caught, you know, because I didn't tell her. I didn't tell my family for two reasons. A, we only had 2 minutes of phone calls allowed during Saddam's time in the 90s. So I really had very limited conversations with my family. And B, Saddam was supporting Milosevic in Serbia. So I was afraid of telling them what I did, lest that would put them in danger. So actually, they didn't know the details mm-hmm. until she came and visited me the year before her death.
The details of Women for Women.
Of Women for Women International. And I actually remember a couple of weeks only before her death, the Kosovo War started. And I was watching the refugees on TV and the crisis there. And I made a decision that this is my mother. And I'm not going to go. Usually I would go. I would be the first to jump on a plane and say, let's go and see how we can set up. But I was like, I'm taking care of my mother and she's dying and I need to stay with her. And I remember her telling me, go. And I said, no, I have to stay with you. And she says, go. I will wait for you. And sure enough, I went, set up the program over there. And a week later, she died.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International, an organization that provides aid to women in war zones. How is it switching from going from New York City, where you live in Tribeca, to Bosnia or Congo? It must be like a mental seesaw. Or are you able to, you know, step back and be more zen about that transition?
I went through all kinds of stages. You know, I went from the stage of really being very depressed the first few years. I would feel guilty about buying a dress or even seeing water. Then to the stage of anger. I was like, oh, people have so much in here. And if you only know, you can save a whole family for the $300 shirt that you have. Then to a stage in which I actually, you know what? The world is everything. The world is dark and light. The world is rich and poor. The world is beauty and ugliness. It's just, you know, so I have no judgment anymore about it. I just live it and appreciate both sides and hope and just really, so I no judgment actually. On the opposite, I actually always urge people to go and enjoy their life. Just share a little. Just share some with those who don't have.
Where do you feel most at home?
Honestly, wow. You know, I call myself the people of the people of the bridge, those who do live between two worlds. Every country triggers something in me, and there's the food or the smell or whatever that I feel like the home feeling. And I can't deny when I go to Iraq, I'm amazed that country has a ability to grab my heart and just capture it. And there's so much about it that I don't like. It's so hot. It's the environmentally, like the smell of gasoline is really bad. But I just, it triggers, it's really have a strong hold on my heart and I love it. And I think home is where my bed is and home is when I meditate and that's sort of what anchors me.
You meditate. So, yeah. For instance, today, have you meditated yet?
Not yet. But I was conscious that I wasn't meditating.
So how about yesterday?
Yesterday I have, indeed.
And how about exercise?
I exercise. I feel very strongly about exercise, actually. And again, this all came really in a learning process because I went through the massacre stage, you know, mm-hmm. of, oh, my God, you know, I have so much more than these women, to now, I honestly believe one needs to enjoy their lives. This is about joy and happiness. I love to exercise. I love to dance. I love clothes. I like looking nice. This is not about, there is this whole myth, at least when I was young, you know, in the 20s, that if you are to work on social activism, that you're supposed to be miserable or not nice looking or whatever it is. And I actually have the opposite.
By the way, you know, you meditate, you exercise, and this, I don't want to sound too simplistic here, but I have thought it would be so helpful for women and men in these regions to be able to get on an exercise bike right. for a half hour and let off that steam and clear their mind. It's underestimated how important that is.
I understand it. But it takes such strong will to sort of get out of it, and a courageous will to get out of that imprisonment, mental imprisonment, and because the physical environment is not friendly either, you know. So is it possible, for example, for a prisoner to exercise in his or her small cell? Yes, there are many amazing stories of people, you know, walking steps in their, you know, in their solitary confinement or doing yoga or whatever. Is it possible? Yes. Does it take an amazing mental will to say, this is how I'm going to defeat it? Yes. Does it happen? People resist in different ways. And this is the story that I learned, the lessons I learned. Resistance and heroism is not in the big, grandiose ways. People resist in small ways. Honestly, when I go to Congo and these women are dancing fiercely, and they were just telling me the stories about their gang raped and their breasts who got cut out in the process of raping. I mean, like torture and all of that. And then a few seconds later, they dance, and that's their resistance. Or running, because we do have Run for Congo women, and Congolese women run in defiance, basically. You know, a woman whose rebels cut off her legs, and she put her artificial leg and run with it just in defiance. So people resist. Bosnian women during the war, I asked them, what do you want me to bring next time I come? They said lipstick. Their resistance was in looking beautiful. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, what Women for Women International do is providing that space for women in these women's centers. We have, I call them safe haven for women, where they can maybe not exercise, but move, because we, you know, part of the classes is to have them move or dance or celebrate themselves. And sometimes it's as simple as needing the space to reaffirm and to re-inspire.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
My guest has been Zainab Salbi, founder of Women for Women International. Coming up, we'll meet Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits, a hardware company that produces electronic modules that snap together with magnets. These electronic modules are accessible to both children and adults, and the company's goal is to encourage creativity and invention by making electronics easier to use. Little Bits was launched in 2011, and the kits are sold in more than 70 countries. Aya graduated with a degree in computer engineering from American University in Beirut and has a master's from the MIT Media Lab. Aya is also an interactive artist. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You grew up in Lebanon. You were always encouraged down the engineering route. How come?
So I actually wanted to be a designer when I was in school, but I was very good at math and science. And so my family, my parents and my teachers told me that I owed it to myself to be an engineer. And I went into engineering because it was sort of the thing to do. But very quickly, I realized that engineering was very dry and very much not creative. And I felt like there was a big piece of my brain, like the creative portion, that was really not engaged. And so those were the seeds of some of the work that I ended up doing with Little Bits.
And also, you are an interactive artist, meaning that you are using technology in your art. Mm. And your focus is on perceptions of Arabian identity. One of your works is Arabia. Tell me about that.
So that was a project that came from a personal place. I had moved to the U.S. For a couple of years, and more frequently than I thought, I would get comments from people that say, oh, you're Arab, how come you're not wearing a veil? Or, you're Arab, are you able to belly dance? And I would get these like very polarized cliches thrown at me all the time. And I'd never thought of these things when I was growing up. And so Arabia was basically a piece that I developed for a fashion show. It's a buddy dancing outfit, and you have the model, the dancer, comes out to the stage and performs this really beautiful, very sensual dance. And then at one point, she flips a switch on her outfit, and through motors, the outfit starts to close on itself and turns into a burqa, just showing these two extremes of stereotypes associated with Arab women.
You're using technology and electronics in your artwork. back playing with the two. And that's what you're encouraging people to do through little bits, basically, just to create and be inventive. What are some examples of some of the projects that the general public creates with Little Big Kits?
At the root, what we are doing, our mission is to put the power of electronics in everyone's hands and make anyone an inventor. We've been described as Lego for electronics or Lego for the 21st century. So they are bricks that instead of being plastic, are lights and sounds and sensors and motors. And with the same ease, you can start using them. Kids have used them to learn about electronics or to create line-following robots. They've created, yesterday we saw a kid who made a flute that makes soap bubbles as he's blowing into the flute through a fan and some sensors. Also things that, you know, there's a lot of energy and attention towards the Internet of Things now. And we do have, with Little Bits, this ability to attach the Internet to anything so that you can bring appliances or devices at home to life and make them controllable with your phone. So we've seen people, for example, make something like a remote pet feeder so that if you're at home at the office and your pet is hungry, you can, through your phone, press a button and have a little motor turn a cup of food for your pets so you can feed them remotely.
You, in 2008, came up with the idea or the early prototypes for Little Bits, but it wasn't until 2011 that you actually launched the company. And it was your boyfriend who encouraged you to kind of stop everything else that you were doing. What's the story there?
So in about April 2011, I had been working on Little Bits as a project, as one of my projects for a few years. And I had gone and found a factory to make it, and I was doing prototypes. And in April 2011, I got the first shipment of a prototype from a factory that I'd been working with in China. And for the first time, I basically saw that Little Bits was manufacturable. And simultaneously, I'd been getting a good amount of press that was interested in the concept of kind of making electronics accessible to kids and adults. And so people would write in wanting to place orders. And so my boyfriend said, you have a product that's manufacturable and you have a customer that wants it. You need to stop everything else you're doing and start a company. And it was kind of like, oh, yeah, why not?
Is he still your boyfriend?
He's my husband now, yes.
Where did you meet him?
I met him in New York, actually. He co-curated a show with MoMA, with Paola Antonelli, called Design and the Elastic Mind, that was about design and science. He was chairing the conference, and I was giving a talk there.
In 2011, shortly after you launched, there was an exhibit at MoMA, or the Museum of Modern Art, where Little Bits was displayed, and Little Bits is now in the permanent collection. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. So there was an exhibit called Talk to Me by Paola Antonelli, who's the head design curator. And the exhibit was about the interaction between people and things. And Little Bits was on display in that exhibit. And it was a huge, huge honor because it was with some of the greatest design and technology pieces of the day. Shortly thereafter, they sent me an email saying that they wanted to acquire Little Bits into the permanent collection of the museum.
One of the germs for Little Bits was the creation of the concrete brick, which you've talked about before, invented in 1868. What is the connection of the concrete brick to your modules?
I believe that, you know, the world keeps changing and the technologies of the day are moving fast. And so in the early 1900s, the technology of the day was a concrete brick. That was the way we started to build larger, more complex structures, one brick at a time. And a little bit after, Lego came out with a play version of that brick in order to empower young and the young at heart to be able to play with that technology that was really ruling the world and be able to make buildings and bridges and these beautiful structures one brick at a time.
And they were called the automatic bonding brick, I think?
Automatic bonding brick was the first name that they had. And now the world has changed again. Now the brick is no longer a cement brick. The brick is now a transistor, which is something that is driving all the technologies around us, the devices we carry, our phones, our alarm systems. They all, at their node, have a transistor. And so what is the play or the imagination version of that brick? How can we put that in the hands of the kids and kids at heart so that they can kind of understand the world and reinvent it? And that's sort of what drove a lot of the work on Little Bits.
What were a few pivot points for you for the company where you felt like you were getting traction from the public?
MoMA was definitely one. In September 2011, basically it was the day I launched the company, and at the same time we were acquired into the Permanent Collection. So it really kind of started us off on a really strong footing and with a lot of confidence and kind of a big stage to play on. And then in February 2012, I became a TED Fellow and I gave a talk at TED, which was also a pivotal moment. It was really a chance to talk about why this is important and why this is important for society, not as a gadget or a toy. It's important as a new way of thinking.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits, a company that sells electronic modules that snap together using magnets. These modules are generally easy to use, making them appealing to the general population, both adults and children. The company was started in 2011, and the kits are sold in more than 70 countries. Aya is also an interactive artist raised in Beirut, Lebanon.
You asked actually on pivotal moments. There is one more. Early on in the company, when we launched, we got an email from NASA, from the education department at NASA, saying that they wanted to collaborate with us to create kits to make space and Earth exploration more attractive to kids. And they came to us saying, you know, we need your help. And that was a huge moment. And we collaborated together to create a kit called the Space Kit, which replicates to a high degree of fidelity, some experiments that are happening at NASA that make this wonder around space and Earth more palatable and more understandable.
What's an example?
You know, in order to wake up astronauts in the space station, NASA sends wirelessly some music to play music as an alarm, and we have a little experiment where you have a microphone and you're playing music from your phone or an MP3 player, and you're transmitting this wirelessly through infrared to a speaker somewhere else.
Ironic that your family really pushed you hard to become an engineer and go down this route, and you did it resentfully as you really wanted to pursue your art, and now you're back where you started.
Absolutely.
With a twist.
Yeah, with a twist.
What does your mother make of this?
My mother has been a huge, huge influence and inspiration on me. When I was growing up, she was doing her master's when I was about 6 or 8. So I would come home and we would do homework together. And so even though I grew up in the Arab world, I never had any idea that there was sort of a different career choices that women and men made. And she's very supportive today as well.
You are part of the maker movement or the open hardware movement. Can you describe that?
The maker movement is really a movement that started around this idea that we should not be just consuming objects around us, that humans were made to be creative and to make with their hands. And that's how you learn. It's how you connect with friends. It's how you invent. And the maker movement is all about sort of making things for yourselves, whether it's arts and crafts, whether it's making electronics. It's really about putting the power back in the hands of the people instead of just the large companies. I do remember kind of early in the 2000s, you started to really see a world where everything was a screen and everything was virtual and every relationship was happening online. And for a lot of people, myself included, that's not a pretty world that I would like to live in. I believe in the tactile. I believe in feeling the satisfaction of having made something. And so what happened is I think that we realized that software in kind of the cloud or in virtual space, without it being on objects and in objects around us, becomes really intimidating and almost not human. And so now the pendulum swung back again to say, all of the things we learned from software, how can we now embed them into devices of all sizes and spaces that are around us?
You attended the iBeam Art and Tech Center in New York. How important was that in the evolution of Little Bits? And what is it?
iBeam is an art and technology lab and center in New York. That was a very, very, very pivotal moment in my life. I had done engineering, and then I went to the media lab at MIT and was doing sort of engineering and art and doing a lot of research around that subject. And then I graduated in 2006 and got a job in finance. And I did finance for 2 years, and I was very, very miserable. And I didn't want to be doing PowerPoints and meeting with hedge funds. And so I quit, and I got a fellowship at IBM. And at IBM, I picked up these ideas of incorporating electronic with arts. And then Little Bits was a second project, just to think about, you know, how do I put this ability to use electronics for creativity? How do I put this ability in the hands of other people, not just myself? Which is sort of the genesis of Little Bits.
In addition to selling these modules, the community aspect of Little Bits has really developed. You have something called a Maker Hub, where people are on your site sharing what they've made, as well as BitLab, which is basically an app store for hardware.
So on the first piece, the community, basically, you know, because Little Bits is essentially a system of these electronic bricks, you know, the point is not the bricks, the point is what you make with them. And so we have a space on the website where there are thousands of projects that people have uploaded with step-by-step tutorials for things you can make. You then have kids that are 8 years old and adults that are 45 years old collaborating on an idea.
What's an example?
We have one of our community members that made basically a surf weather alert because he wanted to know when it was a good tide to go surfing. And so basically connected this motor to make a display that's on a beach that reads from weather data to get like high tide, low tide, and basically creates these notifications that go back and forth and tell him now it's a good time to surf. And that's an example of a collaboration that was across different ages and experiences.
I want to talk about the design of the product. They're white circuit boards with very colorful connectors, pink and blue and green. Can you talk to me about some of those choices?
Electronics are always ugly. They're always green or black, and there's wires sticking out everywhere. And they're the thing you put inside something. You make a shell around it to cover them. And part of sort of the challenge was, how do you make electronics not intimidating? How do you make them inviting? And so one of the tools to cross that hurdle is to make them beautiful, make them exposed so they're open. They're not hidden under any box. They're white because it's less sort of scary. They have this handwritten font on them because it makes them feel human. And they have these neon-colored connectors because we want them to be gender-neutral. People gravitate towards them that never would have put their hand on electronics, whether it's kids, particularly young girls, but also entrepreneurs, designers, artists, people that have no engineering training whatsoever or no interest in engineering.
You mentioned gender-neutral. In what ways are you mindful of encouraging girls to pick up the product?
Getting more girls and women into technology is a hidden agenda of the company, but we don't wear it on our sleeve. What we do is make very, very deliberate choices to make sure that the product, the communication around the product, and everything the company stands for is egalitarian.
I want to talk about venture capital for a moment. You've raised a couple...
So fun.
You've raised a few rounds of venture capital. What have been your impressions of that process along the way?
Raising money is not easy in general. But in addition to that, raising money for a hardware company is difficult. I remember early on in one of my pitches, one investor, very, very prominent investor, told me, I love your business. I love everything you're doing. I think it's going to be a smashing success, but I can't invest in you. Your business is too much of a real business for us. There is the reality. There's physical product and raw material and shipping and taxes and warehouses. And, you know, the barrier to being successful is much higher than making a piece of software and getting a million people to use it. So the hardware component adds to the complexity of raising money. I don't actively think about it, but there is an extra stigma of being a woman.
What is one example?
I'd rather not proliferate the anecdotes, and instead I'll say what I learned and what I think is a proactive way to solve it. I think that the generation before us fought a very hard fight, and we stand on their shoulders for being able to do the things that we're able to do. But now we have a different fight to fight, which is do great work. And I think that the best way to succeed is something that actually Sarah Silverman said once in one of her shows, which is just be undeniable. Be undeniable. And then nobody can come in and say, but she's a woman. It will not happen. And then the third kind of reason why it's difficult to raise money is I got a good piece of advice early on, which is not all money is equal. You can get money from anywhere, but getting the right kind of money or smart money is transformative.
Your modules allow you to do a whole array of things, of one of which most recently is to make music. And you have all these modules in front of me. Can you make some music for me?
Sure. So what I have is a power bit, which is blue, and I'm going to snap it into an oscillator, which is generating the sound wave, and a speaker. And now I'm tuning the oscillator. And then I can put a keyboard. Add a sequencer.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.